Okay, so ever since I could remember, I've been black. But like most black Americans, there's other stuff mixed in. And after a family reunion in Chicago, talking to some of the old timers, I start understanding that in addition to everything else, we've got Native American roots on both sides. Blackfoot on my father's and Chippewa on my mama's. My auntie actually has a picture of my great-great-grandmother looking fierce, staring at the camera, wearing Native regalia. And that's cool, but it doesn't mean anything to me. It doesn't affect my fundamental blackness. So I'm going to school in Ann Arbor, and on the radio, I hear they're going to have the biggest Native American powwow in the country right there. And I figure, maybe I should go. Learn a little something about that part of me, that part of us. The next morning, my girlfriend and I fumble around in the dark, trying not to wake up my roommate and whoever else is laid out in my living room. I grab a shirt, a sweatshirt, and we're out. We get to Chrysler Arena, and it is incredible. We walk through a sea of exhibits and demonstrations and music and storytellers and thousands of people who seem to know each other. And no, I don't feel like I'm going home or something. It feels like the opposite of that. I respect the various Native cultures, but this is new to me. I don't know anything, and I don't want to mess it up. Every single piece is cool. I keep coming back to see dancing competitions between various groups and families and tribes. Dozens of dancers rocking brilliant costumes, festooned in colors and feathers and skins, and they dance, Jack, they dance. Choreographed, rhythmic, hypnotic, swirling body songs, and his beat powered by teams of drummers. And it is awesome and athletic and beautiful and intimidating. And every so often, after the dancing competition, the announcer invites everyone to the floor for an all dance. It's a huge arena where the University of Michigan basketball team plays. But instead of hoops and nets, hundreds of old people and little kids and grizzled men, teenage girls, they take the floor and they dance together in rhythm and community, and it's hypnotic and it's glorious. But I'm just a watcher, watching things go on, careful not to mess something up. But I start to get into the rhythm of the event. I listen to some of the elders tell stories, and I can't keep my eyes off of the dance. The announcer again calls for an all dance, and he puts down his microphone and motions me toward the floor. Go on. Go on. You want to dance? Dance. So I go up to the floor, and I start trying to fall into rhythm behind the hundreds of people next to me. And one thing about my family is that we can dance, and I'm getting it, and I'm getting it, and I'm dancing, and I'm dancing like I've done this before with the drumming. It's a group thing. You dance together. Everyone at the same time, dancing, getting it. And the ladies are smiling. The old men are smiling. And yeah, I'm doing it up. It's physical. I start to get hot. So I take off my sweatshirt tied around my waist. It flaps behind me like a tail, and I've got this. I look toward the side and peep my girlfriend frantically waving me over, trying to get me off the floor. And I'm like, no, 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 not now, darling. Can't you see I'm feeling it? I'm trying to be with my people. Now she's running over, insistent, waving me off the dance floor. What is suddenly so important right now? It has to break my groove. What? She motions for me to look down at my shirt, and I look down at my shirt, and time stops. Emblazoned on my t-shirt is the Cleveland Indians Chief Wahoo, this horrible, bug-eyed, buck-tooth, grinning, bright red, racist caricature of Native Americans. I'm displaying this image on my chest in the middle of a several thousand person powwow. Like wearing a Klan hood at an NAACP rally. And first off, you have to understand, this is not even my shirt. I'm a Detroit Tigers fan. My roommate is from Youngstown, Ohio, and somehow in the dark, I grabbed his stuff. And yes, Cleveland fans, you know this is horrible. Either you know this or you're stupid. Pick one. I'm talking to you too, Washington Redskins defender. You heard me. So like I told you, time stops. Every single person in the entire arena turns around in slow motion to point at me and stare. Heavy condemnation in 1,000 pairs of angry eyes. At least, that's what it feels like as I'm scrambling to pull my hoodie over the offending image, and I run off the dance floor, lickety-split, towards the exit. The announcer sees me. He's seen the whole sorry display. He's like, no. The dance is not over. Scared to look around and see once friendly faces filled with hate, but when I lift my eyes, there's no anger. Everyone's just getting it to the rhythm of the drum. So I try to dance. Try to move my feet. I shuffle, but now I can't get it. I can't get it. It's not working. It's not them. It's me. Then I hear the announcer kind of laughing. He says on the microphone, "Sure is hard to dance under a big heavy sweatshirt." Well, today, on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we proudly present Prion. Amazing stories from real people living outside of everything they hold dear. My name is Glenn Washington. Please get ready. Buckle up. Because this is Snap Judgment.
Oh, no!
I want you to get your music.
I can't take it.
All the whack gimmicks.
I can't take it.
All the fake lyrics.
I can't take it.
All the sex scandals.
I can't take it.
It's more than I can handle.
I can't take it.
All the people hating.
I can't take it.
It gets frustrating.
I can't take it.
This is the last straw.
Oh no, oh no.
Now, we know everything we need to know about ostracism, about exclusion. We learn it from childhood, right? But for our first guest, when she was a little girl, for some reason that sense, it wasn't really directed at her, but instead it followed her father. And the problem was, no one would tell her why.
My sister pretty much sat me down on my bed because I was asking her questions. She was saying that he was sick and that this is what he had. He had paranoid schizophrenia. And I said, what does that mean? And she said it was a mental illness.
Rita's dad lived the life of a shut-in. He kept the blinds closed all day long. She remembers him pretty much sitting around his apartment in his underwear eating cereal.
Yeah, he used to wear these white boxer shorts. And white t-shirt, white socks, everything was white, except for his slippers, that they were black. He wasn't very, very talkative, and he would always speak very softly.
But he did have business associates. He wouldn't go to any office or telephone into meetings, but these guys would come to him in his dark apartment.
And he never spoke on a phone. That was the other thing I realized. Never spoke on the phone. As a matter of fact, most of the time, the phone was off the hook. The other piece that was strange to me was that when these men used to come, you know, his people that were in this business with him, when they used to come and sit around my grandmother's dining room table, the radio would be on, the TV would be on, nobody would be really speaking. There would be more of a whisper. And then people would be, you know, writing notes back and forth to my dad, and he would answer by writing.
There were a lot of things that didn't add up for Rita when she was a kid. Like, if the family did go out to eat, they never had to wait in line at the neighborhood restaurant, and they would get taken in the back door. There were some kids that weren't allowed to come to her house to play, and she didn't know why.
It was this feeling of not knowing truth, you know? Like, I knew something was not right, knew something wasn't the truth. There was a girl in high school that she was spreading a rumor about my family and about my dad and about me, calling me a mafia princess. This went on for a while before I had had my full of her. And there were only few times in my life where I raised my hands. I just said, you know, who the F do you think you are? I wrapped my hand around the back of her head. And I just took her head and I hit her head against the sink in the bathroom, which created all this blood to come out of her nose and her lip. And she fell on the floor, and I hit her again. And I says, don't you ever come here and talk about me or my family ever again. And I walked out. There was so many things that ran through me. And then all of a sudden, the adrenaline kicked in like, oh my God, could this be true? There was something inside of me that day that had to know at that point, you know, what this was, what was going on, what all the secrets, the lies, the whispering, the everything that was happening my whole life up until that time. I was 16 at that time. I got home, I took my bicycle, and I went to a good friend of the family, and I begged them to help me. I had blood on my hands from the girl when I hit her. I was hysterical. And she said to me, sit down. And she said, you know who your father is, right? And I said, no, but I want you to tell me exactly who he is and what's happening, what's going on. She said, your father is the boss of the Genovese crime family. And I took a deep breath, and she said, and that's not it. She says, he's also the head of the five families. The Lucchese, the Genovese, the Bonanno, the Colombo, and John Gotti was from Gambino. Nobody could make a move without asking my dad permission for anything, meaning, say they wanted to do, let's just give an example of they wanted to put a hit on somebody. Nobody can do that unless they ask my dad permission. At some point, my ears shut down because I couldn't hear another word that she was saying, because at that moment, all the pieces of the puzzle from my past that I didn't understand, all of those pieces of the puzzle snapped into place for me. I was really baffled at my dad being this powerful, because when I saw him, he was in a robe, a pair of slippers, and, you know, this was my experience of him. I didn't see him wielding all this power. I said to her, well, what's this whole thing about, you know, my dad having paranoid schizophrenia? And she goes, no, that's just a ruse so that the government thinks that he's sick and that he couldn't possibly be running that family, running the Genovese crime family. And I said, oh, okay. I go home, I'm numb. I'm really numb. You know, my mother knows something's wrong. And I just said, I'm going to my room. And I don't even know how many hours I slept just from being depleted from the whole day. And then she realized that I knew. And, you know, she sat me down, but it was more of a sit me down and just reiterate, you can't tell anybody anything. If anybody asks, your father's sick. There was no kind of explanation, because mom didn't really have an explanation, because mom only knew so much.
Her dad was Vincent Gigante, a man the New York Times said ruled the Genovese crime family with impenetrable secrecy. The Genovese soldiers and associates were forbidden to utter his name or his nickname in conversations or even in phone calls.
It's kind of a known thing in that dynamic. You don't talk about the business or anything having to do with the business. This was not something we sat at the dinner table and talked about. I don't think anybody thinks of their father as actually committing a crime or actually telling somebody to commit a crime. So, yeah, I was definitely having an issue with, were struggling with the fact that he could do that and yet be this loving father at the same time. Once I knew about it and kind of digested it a bit, I kind of became part of the role playing. And so I became one of the actors in this grand scheme. My dad would say to me, "Come on, let's walk." I'd say, "Okay." Tossle the hair, put the hood up, the robe was on, and underneath that he had his pajamas and he wore the slippers, and he says, "Come on, walk me." And so I would be like, "Oh my God," like devastated that I had to go out into the world, you know, with this. So I would be holding his arm. He'd whisper to me, you know, "Hold me up, like make like you're holding me up," kind of thing. And he'd walk disheveled. He would stop and he would mumble under his breath. I'd have my head down, rolling my eyes like, "Oh God, please, can we get this, you know, over with," kind of thing. But there was also the protection that he was my father, and, you know, I wanted to protect him from others who either made fun or whatever. So many emotions going on in that moment. It was not an easy task.
In the neighborhood, Vincent Gigante was called the Odd Father, or the Enigma. And as his play acting became an almost 24-hour gig, the lines between performance and reality blurred.
When you've played that role so many times, there is definitely, you know, a piece of paranoia that has to come with that. Not schizophrenia, but there is definitely a piece of paranoia that has to come with that, where you go, yeah, he's looking over his shoulder for his whole life. When he felt like the government was getting too close, he would check himself into a mental hospital, and he'd stay for about 3 weeks. We'd have to go and visit, to have to walk into one of those places and go to the third floor, which is where, you know, the real sickly people were. These were the people who had paranoid schizophrenia. I was enraged about that piece because I, you know, you walk up in this place and you have people groping at you and saying things, and you see the struggle. I think to myself, you don't have any of this. How could you make a mockery of this? This is not right. This is not, you know, not right. There was a definite pull on both ends. You know, it's like that. It's like that little devil on one shoulder and the little angel on the other telling you two separate things. And you, in deep down, I knew what was right, but also knew that I loved my father. It was like, how could you put your kids through this? How dare you ask us to perform in this way of life? And yet this became the normal way of life for all of us and for him.
There were certain benefits, some privileges that Rita enjoyed being the daughter of a mob boss.
I think what I enjoyed was I felt safe in the respect that nobody could hurt us. But then there was this feeling of, well, yeah, somebody can hurt us because the government can come at any time.
And they did come. After years of extensive surveillance by the FBI, Vincent Gigante was arrested.
These charges represent the government's continuing effort to dismantle the Genovese crime family from top to bottom and to rid this city.
When I was in my 30s, my dad was brought to court for a multitude of things between racketeering and money laundering and attempted murder. And even when dad was in court, he was still trying to kind of keep up the act of being mentally ill. Came in with a robe and slippers, and we were all sitting together. All his children were sitting together in the seats behind him in the courtroom. And when they wheeled him around, he looked at all of us and he smiled at us as if to say, you know, "I see you, I love you, I'm okay," kind of thing. It was heartbreaking in a way. He broke character at that moment because he smiled, and, you know, it was like he was lucid and he knew, and you could tell. Which was, in a way, nice to see because you saw that human side of him again. I don't remember my dad ever feeling free, feeling like, like he could take a deep breath. I think that's what made me sad for him the most. All I could do was hope that he would want to free himself by speaking his own truth for his whole family.
Gigante was convicted and sentenced in his trial.
The extended biological family of Vincent Gigante brushed past reporters.
Excuse me.
Barbara, I'll talk to you soon. Just not right now.
In the Brooklyn Federal Courthouse minutes earlier, 69-year-old Vincent Gigante, in a dark jacket and shirt, white stubble on his cheek, seemed confused. Judge Jack Weinstein sentenced him to 12 years in prison and fined him more than $1 million for labor extortion and conspiring to kill John Gotti and another mobster.
Even after Vincent Gigante was behind bars, federal prosecutors weren't satisfied. They wanted him to admit that the whole mental illness thing was a ruse. So they played hardball, and they went after his family.
And so the only way they knew he would come clean is if he thought that, you know, they were coming after us.
Gigante's choice was laid out before him. Confess, or your family is charged too.
The threat was they would come after us with obstruction of justice on the grounds that we aided and abetted in his little scheme. So he finally came clean. Dad finally came clean, realizing that he didn't want the family to be antagonized in any way. He finally knew it was time for him to speak the truth, which was huge.
When he was 75 years old, Vincent Gigante pled guilty to obstruction of justice, admitting that he had run a con on the legal system for years.
That's not something Dad would have ever, ever done in a million years. Based on that code of ethics, you just go to your grave with this kind of stuff. He didn't have to, but he did. It was like 10,000 pounds was lifted off of me. Oh, this was like an albatross that was hanging around everybody's neck. Dad was tired. He was tired. I really feel like he even willed himself to pass because he knew this was done. Once he admitted it, it was like, okay, I can rest now.
Only a year and a half after his confession, Vincent Gigante died in prison.
If you think about it, my dad, even though he wasn't in jail for 30-some-odd years, he was really in jail. He didn't have a life. It was like living in jail within himself without having the bars in front of him. 77 years? I mean, enough is enough, right? I don't know how he did it that long. I really don't know how he did it that long.
Big thanks to Rita Gigante for sharing her story with the Snap. We'll have more information at snapjudgment.org. That piece, it was produced by Anna Sussman with sound design by Renzo Gorio.
Everybody knows I'm a monster. Conquer, stop your silly nonsense. None of you know where the swamp is. Everybody wanna know what my Achilles heel is. Love, I don't get enough of it. All I get is these vampires and bloodsuckers. All I see is these I made millionaires milling about, spilling their feelings in the air.
Gossip, digging, just stop it. Everybody know I'm a monster. I'ma need to see you put your hands at the concert. I'ma need to see you put your hands at the concert.
Now, when Snap Judgment, the Pariah episode returns, we're about to have our freedoms revoked in a very strange way. When Snap Judgment, the Pariah episode continues, do stay tuned.
I cross the line.
You know that building a strong relationship with your team is key for any business. You've got to meet and collaborate with coworkers and clients on a regular basis. It's necessary to brainstorm, to develop quality ideas and solutions, to just work better. But gathering everyone in the same room can be impossible. And that's why you need GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix. It's a powerful, simple way to meet in person online from anywhere, anytime. And it's so easy. Sign up for GoToMeeting from your computer or your mobile device and launch your first meeting in seconds. You'll be able to share the same screen to collaborate on projects in real time and turn on your webcam to see each other face to face, eye to eye. It's just like being in the same room even when you're miles apart. Start working smarter today by signing up for your free 30-day trial of GoToMeeting. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and use the promo code SNAP. That's GoToMeeting.com, promo code SNAP.
Hey, write this down on the face of your iPod. It's NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's a spirited discussion of movies, books, television, and nostalgia. You can find it on iTunes under podcasts, and it's you wrote it right there on your iPod.
Welcome back to Snap, the Pariah episode. Today, we're speaking with people who've been cut off from the mainstream. And our next guest, Neil White. He was a businessman living well with his wife and kids, and Neil did fine for himself. Fine until being convicted of bank fraud and sentenced to serve 18 months in a minimum security prison in Carville, Louisiana. But Neil, well, I'm going to let Neil speak for himself.
The first thing I remember about arriving at Carville, as I waited for the guard to come collect me, I saw a man walking toward the hallway toward me. He wasn't in handcuffs. He was freely moving, who waved to me, and he had no fingers. And that was the first time that I knew something was awry. I looked around, and I saw men sunbathing on a shuffleboard court, and a dozen men who looked like they weighed 500 to 700 pounds. A bunch of them were playing dominoes. Then I saw a man in a monk outfit riding a bike through the hallways. And as I scurried around and tried to find my room, I saw a woman in her 80s with no legs in an antique wooden hand-cranked wheelchair coming toward me. And as she cranked toward me, her dress lying over the front of the wheelchair, she looked over and said, "There's no place like home." Well, I didn't know what to think. It wasn't at all what I envisioned a prison would be. After I was strip searched by the guard, I asked him who the gentleman was I had seen when I was waiting out by the prison gates, and he said, "It's a Hansen's disease patient." And I said, "What's Hansen's disease?" And he said, "They used to call it leprosy." The next thing I know, when I'm walking through the courtyard, an inmate driving a four-wheeler hauling garbage stops in front of me, and he howls like a dog. And then he looks at me and says, "You know they got lepers here, right?" And I said, I just heard. And he said, "And you're a convict, aren't you?" And I said, "Well, I guess so." He howled like a dog again and said, "Well, that makes you a leprechaun." And then he drove off. Well, when I found out that I was living with 130 people who had leprosy, I was terrified. I knew I could survive a year in a minimum security prison. But my God, if I contracted leprosy, my life would be over. I'd never be able to touch my kids again. I would be disfigured. And so I was absolutely horrified. When I first encountered the leprosy patients, I did see discolored skin and irregular shaped shoes and noses that had been absorbed back into the body, mitten hands where there were no digits on the hands. Physically seeing them, I was terrified. No one knows how it is passed along. They think inhalation of an infected droplet or skin-to-skin contact. I was given a job in the cafeteria, and I was writing the menu board because they found out I could spell and had good penmanship. And I felt somebody tap me on the back, and a leprosy patient in a wheelchair stood up, and he said, "Use the purple. We can see purple the best." And when he said purple, a drop of spit flew from his mouth and landed on my cheek. Frankly, I thought I was going to die. I was walking, I think, to the cafeteria from the inmate side for work, and I heard a woman in a wheelchair call out. And I stopped and saw this woman in a wooden, antique, hand-cranked wheelchair calling out for help. She had started to slide out of her wheelchair. She didn't have any legs. And so I went over to her, and she asked me to help her. And I was reluctant to touch her, but it also looked like she was going to slide out and fall on the floor with just, you know, her upper torso flopping around. And so I reluctantly reached under her armpits and pulled her up and back upright in the wheelchair. And that was the first time I remember touching a patient. The woman's name was Ella Bounds. She asked me to wheel her to her room, and I'll get in trouble if I do that. And she basically said, "What are they going to do, put you in jail?" and so I found myself alone one morning at about 5:30 in the cafeteria with Ella Bounds. And I asked her if I could fix her some coffee, and she said, yeah, she took it with lots of sweets and low, lots and lots of sweets and low. And so I fixed her coffee, and we were sitting there alone, and there were no guards around. So I asked her to tell me her story. And she said, 1912, Denham Springs, Louisiana. And she was in, I think, the fourth grade. A doctor had been to the schoolhouse, it was a one-room schoolhouse where she went to school, to administer shots, and he noticed a blotch on her leg, and he pricked it with a needle, and Ella felt nothing. The next week, a gentleman in a truck drove up, and one of her classmates said, "Ooh, Ella, bounty hunter fixing to carry you away." And a man got out of the truck who had a gun and a coat on, and he came to the door and spoke to the teacher, and the teacher went to Ella's desk and picked her up. Escorted her out, and the gentleman sort of showed his gun, and the teacher left her hand, took her hands off of Ella, and the man pointed to the back of the truck, and Ella climbed in. There was a large sign in big red letters that said quarantine. Ella couldn't read it at the time, but she would later understand. And the man drove away and went to Ella's home to tell her father that he was taking her to the colony. And she never saw her family again. I found myself standing in front of a woman who had been imprisoned for 67 years because she had contracted a disease. I was going to be there for less than a year for mishandling over $1 million. For most of the 20th century, anyone who contracted leprosy was quarantined, and the place they went in the continental United States was a place called Carville, Louisiana. Many times they were brought there in shackles, sometimes at gunpoint, sometimes by a paid driver they called the bounty hunter. Once they arrived at the facility, they were made to change their name. They were given an inmate number. They were not allowed to vote. They were not allowed to marry. Then jump ahead in the early 1990s, and only 130 of these patients are left. A fiscally responsible bureaucrat said, "Hey, I've got an idea. Instead of wasting taxpayers' money on a prison, let's put nonviolent offenders in these empty rooms." And that was how it came to be.
I had been in Carville about 8 months when I discovered that they were deciding they were going to close the prison side. So the inmates were being released early, transferred to other prisons, sent to other medical centers, and the leprosy patients stayed there. If anybody comes to you and says, "We're going to release you from prison a little earlier than you expected," people are jumping up and down. You have to remember that men in prison, they are counting the days. I was talking with Father Reynolds, the Catholic priest who is a Franciscan monk, and I basically said, I'm just appalled that they are still quarantined here and separated from society. And Father Reynolds corrected me and said, oh no, they are free to go. I was stunned. I just assumed that they were not allowed to and that they were in prison as well. And then it hit me that it was even more heartbreaking that they were free to go, but they would rather stay behind those walls in confinement in this safe haven that they had built for themselves than go out and be free. Ella had been in her hand crank wheelchair for, gosh, I don't know, 2 decades. She had no children. She had no family to speak of. And she just said, this is my home now. This is where I'm staying. The reason I think that Ella said there's no place like home repeatedly over and over to the inmate population was that for the leprosy patients, of course it was their prison. Of course they were taken there in shackles. But at the same time, they built this clandestine community with its own mores and cultures. Their prison had become this home. When you are labeled as leper, you have a bond with one another that very few people can understand. They called themselves the secret people, and they liked that. A couple of weeks before I was to be released, the leprosy patients had a dance, and Ella asked me if I wanted to stick around for the first song. I looked around, and there were no guards there, and so I said, sure, we'll do that. I hadn't heard a live band in a few months. So the band started up, and I pushed Ella around the perimeter of the dance floor in her wheelchair. And I would push her the length of the dance floor and then back again and spin her around in circles. And she would put her arms in the air and it looked as if she were flying and we were having an absolutely fantastic time. That was as close to dancing as we would ever have. After dancing with Ella around the side of the ballroom, Smeltzer, a leprosy patient who didn't like us very much, he pointed to me and to 2 other inmates and pointed what was left of his index finger and said, you're not invited. No inmates at our party. And that is when Dan, my roommate, on the way back, walking to the inmate side, said, did we just get kicked out of a leper dance? I had this sense that it was time for me to leave them to continue on with their dance and their story and their life and for me to move on. As the prison began to close and the inmates were transferred to other prisons or released early, the leprosy patients were going to be staying in Carville. And I remember very well saying goodbye to Ella. She was standing in the breezeway. I said my goodbyes and I walked back down the ramp and I stepped into the hallway and turned toward freedom.
Big thanks to Neil White for sharing his story. Check out snapjudgment.org for more of Neil's work and information about the Carville Leprosarium. You're listening to Snap Judgment, the Pariah episode. And when we return, someone is not sorry. Not sorry at all for all the harm they have inflicted. In Snap Judgment, the Pariah episode continues. Stay tuned.
Don't forget to download Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. It's a spirited roundtable of movies, books, nostalgia, and television. You can find it on iTunes under podcasts.
From PRX and NPR, welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Pariah episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and most of us want to be part of a crowd. No one likes to be cast out. But we know sometimes When you walk out to the frame, sometimes good things happen. J.W. Taylor tells us his story live for the wonderful storytelling event, Tales from the South.
It was 1 a.m. when Brother Benji set me and Dana McDuffie down in his office. Dana was looking at me, and Brother Benji too, but I focused on the cross on the wall behind his desk and tried to breathe. "You kids have two options," he said. "Option one, I pick up that phone, call your parents, and tell them to come get you, and I'll let you explain why. Now, brothers and sisters, listen to me. I didn't care if option two meant being stripped naked, dipped in honey, and rolled in fire ants while singing all six verses of Amazing Grace. I was going with option number two. Now, I knew Brother Benji wouldn't kill me and bury me in the backyard, but I wasn't so sure about Mama. I was 14, the summer of 1985, the night of the youth lock-in at Calvary Baptist in Shreveport, Louisiana. For the teenagers, a church lock-in was a stay-up-as-late-as-you-like extravaganza, a night away from home with movies, music, pizza, games, and a bit of hair pulling mixed with the occasional slap fight. For the parents, it was even better. With a promise to pick them up at 8 the next morning, they began dropping their darlings off at 6 p.m., and by 6:15, the church parking lot was enveloped in a thick black fog smelling suspiciously of burning rubber. The man in charge of the 40-plus teens was Brother Benji, the youth minister, who was an angry little man with slumped shoulders, a squatty face, thick glasses, and the joyful spirit of a man under a perpetual IRS audit. He had shooed us into the fellowship hall and led us in prayer before outlining the rules that no one in the room intended to follow. Then he turned us loose. I grabbed some pizza and talked to some friends, all while watching Dana McDuffie. For weeks, Dana and I had been engaged in that time-honored teenage courtship ritual of circling each other like feral cats. Staring and preening and puffing, neither willing to make the first move. Feats of strength and fluttered lashes, a bicep flex and a hair flip. Cologne and perfume applied in such copious amounts that we could smell one another through walls. It was all prelude and preparation for tonight. I decided tonight was the night. But I was nervous. I was new to the game of love, but Dana had what we in the evangelical community called a reputation. And unlike leprosy or rickets, you couldn't take vitamin D or rub some aloe vera on a reputation and make it all better. A reputation was terminal. But I didn't care. I decided. So around midnight, when I found Dana alone as she was coming out of the girls' bathroom, I made my move. Want to talk? That was my move. I had practiced it for weeks in the mirror, but then Dana threw me a curveball. Talk about what? Now, if my move had been a ship, they'd have been ringing bells and handing out life jackets because there was 6 foot of water in the boiler room. In my practice mirror sessions, Dana had always responded either yes or no. I was woefully unprepared for her to answer my question with a question. So I just stood there in the wreckage of my move, the smell of my own sweat and a half bottle of Stetson burning my nostrils. Dana gave me kind of a sideways look, like the RCA dog. And then she smiled, and she grabbed my hand, and we ran through a side door into the church courtyard. We found another open door, and she led me up some stairs and down some others until eventually we arrived in the elementary Sunday school wing. At the end of a long hall, we opened the door to the first grade classroom. I turned on the light. She turned it off. Shortly thereafter, we commenced to sinning. Now, I may have been new to the game of love, but it didn't take me long to figure out that we weren't playing the same game. Dana was playing bridge and chess and backgammon all at the same time. I was hitting rocks with hammers. Yet, just about the time I was learning how to hold my own, I was blinded by a bright light, not unlike what I imagine Saul experienced on the road to Damascus. Only instead of God's voice, I heard Brother Benji's. And to this day, I don't know how he found us or how he even knew we were missing. But he had called us at play on the fields of love, and he promptly called the game on account of darkness in our souls. And so the long, slow walk back to his office. He sat us down and shut the door, took off his thick glasses and tossed them on his desk. He rubbed his wee little face, rubbed it again. I looked at Dana. She looked at me. Silence. "You should be ashamed," he said. "Ashamed. This is God's house, a place of worship, and you two have turned it into a den of iniquity." Thus began an impromptu sermon on the evils of the flesh. And as he spoke, I was struck by two almost simultaneous revelations. One, for the first time in my life, I was a fornicator. Two, I should not have been quite so happy about it. I had committed a real, live, grown-up sin, and it was all I could do to keep the smile in my heart from reaching my face. But my parents didn't take me to church every Wednesday and twice on Sunday for nothing. My temporary euphoria was replaced by the cold and creeping feeling that now, after 14 years, all 10 of the commandments were suddenly in play. Instead of just keeping the Sabbath holy and honoring my mom and dad, now I had to watch out for coveting my neighbor's wife, along with bearing false witness, whatever that was, and murdering and thieving and adultery. A whole new world was opening up, and I was afraid it was going to swallow me whole. "Are you listening?" Brother Benji said. "Yes, sir." Then he gave us the options. Call our parents, or option two. And so it came to pass that option number two led us back to the fellowship hall, to a small raised stage in the front of the room, the congregation before us, Brother Benji behind us. And in a loud voice, Brother Benji did say, "J.W. Taylor, confess before your peers and your God." And lo, I froze. Never had 40-plus teenagers been so quiet. The whole scene seemed like a photograph, a still life. No one was moving except me. As bad as I was shaking on the outside, it was worse on the inside. Voices and laws and rules and commandments were swirling in my head, love and lust and heaven and hell all blurred together until I couldn't figure out what I needed to confess because I couldn't keep track of all my sins. "J.W.," the voice said. Dana took my hand. Her hand was as warm as mine was cold. I took a deep, shaky breath and said, "Me and Dana went to the Sunday school rooms and kissed and stuff." The voice, "And what you did was wrong, wasn't it?" "Yes, sir." "And you won't do it again, will you?" "No, sir." Dana let go of my hand. I had a lot to learn. And again, the voice, "Dana McDuffie, confess before your peers and your God." And then it happened. Dana took two steps forward to the front and center of the stage, and she confessed, and confessed, and confessed. In fact, she confessed in such vivid and salacious detail that Brother Benji tried to keep her from confessing anymore. But that only made her confess louder. And the louder she confessed, the smaller Brother Benji became, until he receded completely into the background of the great passion play that was unfolding before him. And the more Dana confessed about what had transpired in that first grade Sunday school room, the more I began to wonder whether I'd even been there. It was a tour de force of repentance. And when Dana finally finished her stem-winding confession, the wee little man behind her didn't ask if what she had done was wrong or if she was going to do it again. He just stepped down off the stage and walked right out the doors of the fellowship hall, leaving me and Dana and our peers and our God to figure out what to do next. When I woke up later that morning, Dana was gone. My parents picked me up, and I rode home in silence. I went to bed and slept another 6 hours without dreaming a single dream. I never saw Dana McDuffie inside the walls of Calvary Baptist Church again, but I saw her again the next Friday night, and the one after that, and the one after that.
We want to thank J.W. Taylor for telling his story. That piece was recorded and produced by the folks over at Tales from the South. And they've got plenty more where this came from. Check out their podcast at talesfromthesouth.com. We're going to have a link at snapjudgment.org. So, it's that time again. But don't you fret. Don't you frown, Snap Nation. Full episodes, movies, pictures, stuff awaits your pleasure right now at snapjudgment.org. Find out the story behind the story. Join us on the Facebook, Snap Judgment, Twitter, Snap Judgment. Snap was produced by myself and a group that would never leave Will Urbina alone in the woods, in the cold, after a team building exercise again. Never. Please say hello to the Uber producer himself, Mr. Mark Ristich. He might be lost, but his beats are found. Pat Mesiti Miller, Anna Heart of Gold Sussman, Julia, I'll have my steak rare DeWitt. Any business propositions are run by Snap Judgment's own consigliere, Renzo Gorio. Lightning Joe Rosenberg keeps the peace. Jasmine Aguilera keeps us out of jail. And Will Urbina, he ain't talking. No matter how many times you lose them in the woods. Now, if you're looking for a good deal on a queen-size mattress, look no further, my friends, than the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Ask them about the buy one, get one free special and tell them Snap Judgment sent you. Much love to the CPB. PRX is pronounced exorbitant if you say it backwards phonetically, which is what I would advise. They really like it when you do that. PRX.org. Never fear, because WBEZ in Chicago knows just what to do. And you may have heard that this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you get teased at every level. People could hate you and call you names and throw sticks and stones and despise every single thing you stand for until you get some nerd glasses and start telling stories of these American lives. Even then, you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.